Good evening and welcome to the Michigan Writers Series. Tonight's guest is Robert Fanning. Robert Fanning is the author of Old Bright Wheel, Ledge Press Poetry Traffic Award 2003, and The Seed Thieves, Merrick Press 2006. His poems have appeared in numerous journals, including Poetry, Plowshares, The Atlanta Review, The Hawaii Review, America, The Ledge, and Art World Quarterly. A graduate of the University of Michigan and Sarah Lawrence College, Robert Fanning's writing awards include a Creative Artist Grant from ArtServe Michigan, the Inkwell Poetry Award, and the Foley Poetry Award. Will you please join me in welcoming Robert Fanning?
Thank you so much, Peter, and it is an absolute pleasure to be here in East Lansing at Michigan State University. I'm going to read selections of poems this evening from my recent book, The Seed Thieves, as well as a few poems that are not published yet, but which will hopefully find their home in a book. I have another book that's slated to come out next year. So I'm going to start with a poem that was inspired by a story I read about a man who played the role of a dead person in a play, and it was an ongoing production. So he, played this dead man every night, and it got me thinking, how do you rehearse for such a role? This poem is called Dying Star. You appear in only one scene, late in the last act. The curtains part, and there you sit, a bloodied, blue-lipped lump of a body slumped center stage. The lead lady screams over you, her dead secret lover. Stillborn into the life of the stage, you disappear after one roll. No spotlight bows, no throne bouquets, no afterglow. Curtains closed, house lights up, your name buried in a program out in the slush. But for this brief center stage appearance, you spent hours rehearsing every nuance and gesture of the man who sits for hours on the park bench, barely blinking, of Sunday's congregation dozing through homilies, of shopping mall hordes dragging bags and blank stares, of the local mortician eyeing a gray slab of meat in the late night diner. No one noticed as you hunched like a vulture in the wings, watching, perfecting the fine art of stopping your heart. Even in your only scene, lost in the umbra of the darling starlet, you're invisible as dust circling the spotlight's long beam. Understudy of everyone alive, short-lived star, it's you, death, we'll recognize too late behind hospital curtains in passing as we leave our own small stage, relinquishing each letter of our famous names to you. The next piece was occasioned by, in a time when I was reading Camus and Sartre. I was probably in my 20s and hellbent had a very existentialist look at the world and felt that there was really nothing behind the curtain, and that all came crumbling down when I approached a field of fireflies. This poem is called Failed Existentialist in a Field of Fireflies. A blizzard of absurd low stars or searchlights on a far shore, this dance of tiny fires draws me in. I watch within the larger darkness these flares ignite. This green flurry, a bright show of force against a black sea. They surface, disappear, and surface again. From what flames do these rise, these embers flashing over me. How can I, who've outlived God, survive this sudden desire to pray? There are some who see it coming, and there are some who don't. And this poem is about some people who didn't see it coming. And it's called 1.5 miles Away from Dying. 1.5 miles away from dying, the people in this car, unaware their sacred closing moments are here, exhaust their last travel game. In the back seat, the girl hums, braiding her sister's black hair. The boy traces his name in breath on the back window, each slow letter squeaking the chilled glass, making his mother shiver. Like a fish trapped in thin pond ice, gasping, she stares into the car through the visor vanity mirror. Her lips glisten under the lipstick wand. Yawning, the driver's face is caught wide open in passing headlight amber, his left hand draped over the wheel at the wrist. His other hand tries to retrieve the lost voice of the late world news reporter, her words garbled by cloudbursts shattering over the flat horizon east. Shutting the radio off, he tries to lure his kids to sing one they know by heart. He turns the rearview mirror until it holds their three faces. Half in shadow, placid, they peer at him below, his cheeks splashed green by dashboard light. The clock's last digit clicks one more minute. Beyond the blind curve, a truck's hulk of silver screeches over the median wall. An oil tanker, sparks raging, airborne, careens toward this side of the freeway, meteor tail of flame like a missile shot astray. Back in the car, before the turn, it is quiet. The people smile, doing last-minute things. One scratching an ankle, one blinking, one taking a breath, preparing to sing. I had, for a period, written several rather dark poems, and I figured it was time to challenge myself to write one that wasn't quite as dark. And I figured starting with the title Happiness might help. Happiness. Happiness, that fatted calf, hangs from the ceiling by a thread. Silly-eyed and frilly, the piñata teases, swaying like a plump ballerina above the birthday party guests. When the blindfold goes on, when laughter and light disappear, I'm told to thrash the high darkness until I hit it. Look at me, the village idiot, shaking my fist at the night sky, taking jabs at its flank, hoping to stab the elusive cloud, to start a shimmering candy river for all the thirsty villagers below. I know they watch from behind the windows of their dark homes, dreaming the red gold rain. We each want a taste of it, thirst for it, want it to fall in our hair, to bounce from our palms, to get on our knees and thrust our fists into its shattered rainbow shards. We won't stop until the last sun-flaked drop spills, until every piece of joy's flash flood is gone. And when it's done, when we're all singing over short candles, slurping blood-red juice from our thumbs, playing with our new toys, after the lucky kid fishes one last piece from the sea of wrappers, we'll be sure not to look up, where that gutted cardboard carcass arcs like a hung god, dragging like a sharp pendulum over our heads, a drained slab on a hook, a reminder of the dry season, of need and loss and the empty hours we've all long forgotten. I always thought I would never really write overtly political poems until I realized that it's a necessity. And I believe in this current climate it is. And as a poet particularly, I'm struck by the names of things, obviously, and have found increasingly the names of our wars extremely exciting. This poem is called The Man Who Names Wars. We've come so far in the art, from such early shots in the dark as the Revolutionary War, with a far from revolutionary name. 100 years war, oh please. World War I to end all wars until World War II and counting. The Korean, Franco-Prussian, Vietnam, insert new country, war. In fact, only a couple decent stabs on the whole bloody list. The War of the Roses, and maybe the Civil War, at least an oxymoron. In his defense, whoever held this post then, the man who names wars, probably named these after the fact, or during, while scalped and bleeding on horseback, or limbless in a last haze of morphine, not thinking the rest of us will need to live with these names forever. But now, we know the act of naming wars is half the battle. So we're preemptive and precise, finding our target audience long before the war begins. Somewhere deep in the Pentagon tonight, no doubt, a new think tank's burning midnight oil as we speak. The top brass's army of creative hired guns, those sloganeers who, given the scope of a future mission, are cocking their pens, aiming for a new name. We can only guess where this platoon's been recruited from. A few failed poets pulled from the rank and file, an ex-Hallmark vet fond of Wilfred Owen, and one who went AWOL mumbling Tennyson in 46. Whoever they are, make no bones about it. They know no one will buy it if it doesn't taste just right. It's gotta have pizzazz, a fierce logo, spurned Uncle Sam emerging from Thunderheads, and a drum roll name that makes even the diehard doves go hawkish when they see it on Fox. Just listen to these recently labeled products roll in. Desert Storm, Desert Shield, Operation Enduring Freedom, the War on Terror. Can't you feel your heart go full-on bald eagle at these names? It's clear there have been major advances in this field. We've learned you can't just call hot sauce hot sauce. Instead, try Sergeant Frank's flamethrower or Jumpin' Jack's ass-kicking fire juice. We've learned a well-named war will scorch the tongue. So, in the end, rest assured, there'll be no World War III, but Operation Global Infernal Glory. They're already dipping their quills for that one. I was raised Catholic, and among many somewhat terrifying things was limbo, which is, for those of you who aren't Catholic, essentially where they decided to put the babies that weren't baptized, which was terrifying to me, always. But I realized recently, or came across the news, that the current pope decided to abolish limbo, which I suppose is fine, but which led me to the thought of what in the hell is going to happen to all the babies that were in limbo. Didn't see anything about the relocation of those babies. So that inspired this poem, which is called Limbo's Babies Softly Falling. Since the 13th century, they've floated in limbo, the souls of dead, unbaptized babies, cooing and orphaned, their moony faces peering out from the clouds of their sweet little death gowns at their mobiles of real stars and planets. Saint Gregory of Nazianzus, 329 to 390 AD, gave birth to the notion of limbo. Prescient enough to know, the faithful wouldn't go for the thought of pudgy, unblessed newborns pierced like mini wieners on the pitchforks of demons sitting around hell's eternal campfire. To him and others, it seemed half decent. A compromise whereby these little less than desirable babies could have a celestial cry room, albeit at the far reaches of heaven, so their sinful wailing wouldn't disturb the Lord. Saint Augustine of Hippo, 354 to 430 AD, profoundly disagreed, reasoning that babies, even the snuggliest ones, if they ain't been dunked in the holy pool, then they ain't getting in. Though he added an amendment to the idea that in hell, they wouldn't be tortured quite as badly as the rest. 900 years later, when the idea of limbo finally came into being officially, St. Thomas Aquinas began speculation already that maybe limbo shouldn't exist, but it has for 7 centuries. 7 centuries of this poorly lit backroom nursery in heaven's maternity ward. 7 centuries of screaming babies stained with original sin and spit up. Angels coming and going in the halls with nasal aspirators and burp cloths stuck caring for the un-Catholic dead ones. Until this year, when, with one stroke of his pen, gallant in his robe, Pope Benedict declared these babies would no longer be in limbo. At the moment of this edict, limbo's floor and walls evaporated, whoosh, and the souls of limbo's babies began to fall, feather light, down through the spheres, through clouds and soft rain, some settling in streams, some in beds of long grasses, others gently rocking in treetops. And all across the earth, grieving mothers and ghosts of grieving mothers came out into the fields, their arms outstretched, weeping with elation, ready to catch and cradle them, and before God comes to snatch them back, to carry them, their dead ones, home. Recently, I was watching the local news, which I never advise, but I was struck by something I saw on the news, and I always tell people, especially other writers, to never underestimate the power of the local news to provide good fodder for poems. In this particular story, a deer burst into the Target department store, which became this poem. A deer in the Target. I only got a 10-second shot. Grainy footage of the huge deer caught in the crosshairs of a ceiling security camera. A scene of utter chaos in a strip mall store shown on the late local news. The beautiful beast clearly scared to death in this fluorescent forest, its once graceful legs giving out on mopped floors. Think Bambi as a fawn, its first time standing. Seeing the scattering shoppers, you'd think a demon had barged into this temple of commerce as they sacrificed their merchandise, stranded full carts, and dove for cover. And when the aisles were emptied of these bargain hunters, who was left but an army of brave, red-shirted team members, mobilized by the store manager over the intercom to drive this wild animal out. I wager there's nothing on this in the how to approach an unsatisfied shopper section in the Target employee handbook, But there they were, the cashiers and stockers, the floor supervisor, the assistant floor supervisor, the store manager, the assistant store manager, the district associate manager, the district supervisor, the district assistant supervisor, and visiting members from the regional corporate office, running after it. It running after them, bullseye logos on their golf shirts. Everyone frenzied and panting, razor hooves clattering on the mirror white floor tiles, nostrils heaving, its rack clearing off-season clothes from clearance racks. All of them in Target, chasing the almighty buck.
I'm gonna read a poem about my brother, who was a beautiful person and who committed suicide last year. And as with any death or loss of someone we love, we immediately see a film strip in our heads of all the times they spent with us. And it took me to a time when my brother taught me his very unique way of whistling, which is through his teeth, and which I was extremely proud to learn. This poem is called "The Boy Who Taught Me How to Whistle," for Thomas Arthur Fanning, 11-1160 to 10-805. He showed me what to do with the air, my brother, one summer morning when he was 16 and I was 6. How first you lift your chin like this, move your jaw back a bit, now let your tongue rest under your teeth. No, sort of curl up the sides. Yeah, kind of like that, like a little boat. Okay, now take a deep breath, now blow it out. I imagine it was nothing but hissing my first several tries as my brother listened, sitting beside me on the cool cement porch in shade. Maybe it was even days later when a small wind slipped through my teeth and took on song. And I bet I ran to show him, saying, "Listen, listen." See, no one else knew how to whistle this way, like us, my brother and I. My brother who left no note the night he chose nearly 30 years later to stop his breath. My brother, my snap-necked loon, my slack-jaw goner, my stone epiglottis, my brother now hung in his new dark womb, a stopped clapper in an iron bell. Around that same time of my brother's death, my wife, her aunt died. And of cancer, which she had been suffering with for some time. But my son was 6 months old at the time, and being there with him was quite a contrast. This poem is called "Tributary." Miles away, Aunt Joyce drifts in the slow flood of her dying, lying in the cancerous raft of her body. Here in this house, we wait in separate rooms for news of her imminent death, avoiding the telephone, that black tumor on the wall, its dark cord a dangling hook. Every hour's a floating mountain of ice grinding past the window. Late in the day, when the wave of her death crashes into us, we're drawn into the living room. Sitting with the mourners, Aunt Joyce's shattered family, each clinging to each other, I cradle Gabriel, my infant son. Watching his face, I see a sudden great smile surface, a bright fish, a sweet, foolish leaping. Almost ashamed, I move to cover it, this untimely delight on the mouth of my son, all stirring and giddy, who has yet to learn the appropriate response to death, or who is only just trying to teach us.
This next poem is quite timely, really, because it has to do with Gabriel, my son, who's now 22 months, and his recently I've noticed he's starting to become afraid of the dark, or appears to be. And last evening, actually, our power blew out, so I was actually reading to Gabriel from Dr. Seuss with a flashlight in our house, so this poem is particularly timely. And it deals with two kinds of darkness. And it's entitled, "The Darkness, Literal and Figurative." Neither should frighten you, but both will. Tonight, it's the literal darkness, figuratively. Your day's stuffed animals, now poised shadows, ready to leap and devour you. Now I'm here with you, midnight, your living father, literally, arms around you to say, as your known shapes take misshapen forms, no, everything you can't fully see suggests more than it is. Later, it'll be the figurative dark, literally, the stuffed shadows of your dazed anima, poised now ready to leap and devour your loves. Later, I'll be with you here, midnight, your dead father, figuratively, arms around you to say, as your unknown misshapen shapes form, no, everything you can't see fully suggests more than it is. Neither should frighten you, but both will." I'm going to close this evening's reading with a poem also about darkness. And for a long time in my life, I was believing in the metaphor, the cliched metaphor of the light, run to the light, and light this and light that. And this poem was realizing that when I close my eyes, I have all that I need to see. And it's entitled, "Light's Bright Lies." Tonight I leave the white electric hum of streetlights, those killing globes that cause moths their last thrusts of faith and delirium. Dumb believers starving for light, the gauze of their dead wings covers my fingers with dust. I've learned from them a daring trust in darkness saves a life. Tonight I leave the tease of light's bright lies that led me by its touch to believe I see. Walking through a dark field, my eyes give in. Behind their lenses, in absence of light, another aperture opens. The same sense with which I watch in every sleep a life inside my life take shape. As if another light goes on beneath, a ship's lamp scanning reefs that reveals a cave once lost to sight. In that world shines a silver streaking eel, the real light that burns by what it feels. Thank you. Thank you so much. I can certainly answer any questions if you have any. Maybe I inspired more questions than answers, but that's fine. Sure. Well, I do write. I write a mixture of styles and forms. Some of them are in received forms, you know, sonnets and so on. And I do pay particular attention to the meter of the poems, even when I'm writing in free verse. But my writing process typically begins with, as you said, free writing. I'll write in a journal, just get the thoughts onto paper, and then begin to shape them into a poem. And sometimes the poem will take a rigid form, and sometimes it won't. And I think sometimes you just have to honor the poem. Often, I like to say that oftentimes when we're writing, we really write ourselves into the center of a really dark forest, and then the challenge is getting out. And oftentimes, 5 or 6 lines into a poem, I'll realize that I'm sort of somehow intuitively or instinctively working with very close rhymes, and it doesn't take much to begin to shape that into a poem with a particular rhyme scheme. But then oftentimes I will just write in free verse, but free verse is a dangerous word, because I think even then I really believe you need to pay particular attention to the sound, the line lengths. You know, what separates poetry from prose is the music of the language, is the way that the poem is shaped on the page. I like to say that the page itself is merely a blueprint for the song of the poem. So when I read the poem, or when somebody else reads it some time from now or far away from me, they have a sense of how it is to be read by the way it is on the page, which is the main difference for me between poetry and prose. And that's why I write the way that I do, paying a lot of attention to the line breaks. So in a very circuitous way, I hope there's an answer in there somewhere.
Yeah, I'm just curious, the English writing, because I know my language, we have kind of classical, you know, style, mm-hmm. very strict, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love poems. You know, I read all kind of poems, but they translate to Chinese, not English. Mm-hmm. So I try to understand. Sometimes just when they translate during this process, they lost the feeling. You know, the text. You just feel different.
Yeah. Sometimes that's the case. When you read some contemporary poems, you don't really. For me, you don't get that skeletal framework of the sound and the form, and I don't particularly like that type of poetry. I feel like a poem, to me, is working on many different levels. I mean, you have the content of the poem, the narrative, the story, whatever you want to call it, but then the shape, the form, and I love working within that strictness, within that box. I think that is the joy of writing a poem to me. It's kind of, we create these puzzles for ourselves, and then we try to solve the puzzles. So I think there's a lot to be learned working in form and working in strict meter and then finding a way out of it, or working in a variety of ways. So I love writing that does follow a strict form. But the dangers therein are that writing can be very box-like and stale. Countless times I've written a poem in strict form and squeezed all the joy and passion and life experience right out of it. I mean, it might be scientifically a perfect poem. Well, that'll never happen, but a very good poem, but it doesn't translate to the reader. There's no emotional quality in it. So it might be a very, very beautiful, ornate container of nothing. So I think the challenge is with form is setting it up, but then working against it, using the music to create surprise. You know, the oft-quoted quote of Robert Frost is, you know, no surprise for the reader, no surprise for the writer. So I think that needs to be there too. I mean, you can write a very, you know, precise poem formally that can be incredibly dull. And frankly, there's a lot of poems written with no attention to form that can be incredibly moving and have their own music. So there's room for everything.
Is there any one particular language that lends itself to the rhythm and the cadence, or is every language unique as far as poetry is
concerned? I think every language is unique. I'm sure our Chinese poems have a very different cadence. And I think some of the challenge for translators is trying to bring over that music to English, which doesn't always work. In fact, quite often doesn't. In English meter, we have our particular rhythms and, you know, iambic rhythm and pentameter and all that, which they say it captures English well, and I think does. I mean, writing in an accentual syllabic verse, there's a certain rhythm to it that fits the way we speak, the way we breathe, the arrangement of our words. So I think it's different for every language, and I would hate to be a translator trying to bring an amazing Chinese poem into our language, and it takes really brilliant people to pull that off.
I have a question. In Anything with the arts, the act of criticism and teaching is very difficult, especially with young people. You're encouraging to just get it all out.
Right. Well, I think the most important thing, and the answer probably to your question you just said, is paring things down. I think what I realized in working with young people was I don't necessarily want to do that early on. I want them to gush and get their words and enjoy just the pleasure of words and getting them on the page and the just real excitement of that. Later on, we'll start to look at some of the, particularly editing devices and ways of kind of looking at cliche and teaching them how there are certain words, phrases that and sentences and utterances that have been done a million times and oftentimes they're drawn to those because they've heard them. We get "Roses Are Red" poems all the time from young people. We get really, and there's certain patterns, and some of them are really developmental. I mean, you've got high school students who are kind of coming to themselves, learning who they are, their identity is being discovered. So they're writing really angst poems. They'll turn toward political things. And if they're not doing that, then typically they're writing these really gushy, bad love poems. So it's a challenge because you want to teach them the love and the pleasure of writing, but you want to show them how good writing differs from bad writing. And it is subjective, but there is a certain level of objectivity to it. I mean, so we bringing in model poems that are age appropriate, showing them, they have to hear a lot of poems. They have to really get the feel for them and see what they are on the page. Part of our challenge is we're working with students who are learning how to make sentences or they're learning how those sentences make a paragraph. So on one hand, they're learning, the very rigorous grammatical, I'll say in a jaded way, dull side of writing. And then we come in trying to jazz them up and get them to think outside the box and break their sentences apart. So but the focus on editing and getting them to realize that editing is part of the fun aspect of the process. I often hold up a pencil and I'll say, "What side of the pencil do we write with?" And of course they all go, "That side, the pointy side, the lead side." And I say, "Not always." And I flip it around and we talk a little bit about how important that eraser is and how sometimes knocking out some words or leaving a little mystery to the reader is so important. So, but it is challenging.
What are some textbook poems, poets that you like to use when you're teaching poetry to beginning high school, junior high?
I've been teaching young people now for probably 5 years, and I think I made the mistake early on of coming in with some kind of older dead poets who I adore, but that weren't really getting them excited. So at some point I realized, even though I still will sprinkle those in, I want them to feel the history of some of the writers who've come before. But I think there are some great models out there of poets, especially contemporary poets, who are writing very accessible poems, some formal, some not formal. There's a pretty good anthology for high school, a collection of poetry for high school students that came out a couple years ago, Poetry 180. That's got some great models in it for high school students. Then there's a whole bunch of great poems for young people. And I mix it up. I think, having them read, even in high school, some Dr. Seuss stuff next to Shakespeare or Dylan Thomas, and just exposing them to so much. And then one thing that I learned was using their peers' poems as models is particularly good. In our program in Detroit, as I said, we publish books at every one of our schools. And when I realized how good these poems are, and that I can arrange a lesson around a theme that a kid their same age who lives across town wrote, that is particularly great, because immediately they say, "Oh, I can feel that. I know what he's talking about. I know." So that's great. I mean, realizing that at every part of their development, there's different poems that are good. So there's plenty of good of even an internet search would probably bring you some good models. But I think I learned that maybe the mistake that even some teachers today still do is
thinking that the poets they loved as a young person or the poets they love now are going to, you know, it's remembering to be young. It's kind of putting yourself into their seat, you know, which to them is very big, and holding the pencil, which to them is a branch of a tree, and really putting yourself into their perspective. I mean, and thinking, you know, why would this poem, which means so much to me as a 35-year-old, would it mean so much to a third grader or a 10th grader? So being open to bringing in those moments.
Do you use music at all?
I use a number of things. I'm very passionate about music and poetry for me are very much kind of two of my great loves that are often competing with one another. I bring in music, and in our program specifically, I try to train our writers to not just come in with the same model of today we're going to read a poem and then write. You know, I think I like to bring to our writers the notion of disequilibrium. Often people learn best when they are in disequilibrium, meaning that something has taken them out of the mode of learning, and they're kind of on their heels. That could be bringing in a sculpture or a painting or even a conversation that's completely has nothing to do with their school day, or something that's going to jar them out of their sixth grade world of social studies and math. And you know, they've come in, you know, like little soldiers into their desks, and you want to, I mean, our job is to bring them to mystery and get them excited. So I do use music. I've done lessons where I will bring in a tape that I've made, an assortment of all kinds of music, you know, and it'll just be little snippets. There'll be like a 15-second snippet of 20s jazz and then hip-hop, and then it'll go back, you know, it'll be Edith Piaf, and then it'll be opera, and then it'll be some really creepy Brian Eno song, and you know, and they just write, they free write to that, and they tell them to go where the music takes them, and they write these amazing things. And so I find oftentimes pulling them away from the page and from books into that dream world that inspires the writing is really important, and especially visual art too, to just put a piece of art or a photograph in front of them and tell them to disappear into it. I mean, a lot of our writing, what inspires writing comes from that other kind of dream world space that we live in while we live our lives, and you have to give them that in order, you're asking them to go outside of the universe and to pull something down from it. You've got to take them there. You've got to take them on a journey. So we use a lot of things like that to get them excited. That's a fascinating question. I do believe that there's plenty of things you can learn about writing a poem. There might be some people who maybe have a better intuitive sense or who might find poems easier than others. But we all feel. We all have access to our emotions. And if you've got that and you know how to speak and write, you're pretty much on your way, and you can learn by practice. And I really do believe that everyone can write very well. Some, as I said, will it'll be easier to them. It'll come to them a little bit more simply than others. But if you can feel and you can write, you can find a poem, and you can write a great poem. But again, it's like any other. It's a craft, and it comes through practice and dedication and sweat and pain and misery and and joy and all of that stuff that maybe some people won't allow themselves to get into enough. I think it really takes a certain willingness to kind of go into your life. Theodore Rethke, who's a poet I absolutely adore, said that people don't like poetry because it asks questions of their lives. And I've always thought there's some element of truth to that. You know, you're going into your emotions, which is where your poems are pulled from. But if you can go in there, into that cave, there's plenty of gems in the walls to be mined, you know. Just put on your helmet like everybody else and start chipping away.
I should show you the building on campus. Theodore Rethke taught here. And there's this classic story of him that he was in the home economics building across the circle here and teaching just, you know, like a freshman. He was in one of his moods or whatever, and he threatened to jump out the window.
Wow.
Soon after that, he was asked.
Well, he was certainly one of the best teachers of all time of poetry, and he's got a couple wonderful books about teaching. And I think he was such a good teacher because he taught with passion, and he it was completely the same passion and creativity that drove his writing drove his teaching. And I believe that that's true of all good teachers. It wasn't just, you know, here's the lesson, here's the material, here's what you got to learn. You know, wasn't that? It was he was on fire and wouldn't take, you know, he forced his students to really, you know, he believed in the craft and you've got to study it. But he also believed that you should teach the poems that you love, that even as a he would bring in models from his childhood. I mean, he had a real affinity for language of all types. And so I think he's just a phenomenal. I love being places where he's been. I still haven't made my way to Saginaw to see, you know, his real stomping ground. But he's definitely been a big influence on me.
Oh,
it was.
He's a 22-month-old to get home to us.
Yeah, yeah. He'll.
He's now,
just about now. He's going down. So. But it was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.